Hello and welcome to Alchemy 101, the show that explores all avenues of transformation and aims to offer some useful nuggets that can support us in living in line with nature in a way that's true to our nature, no matter how contrary that might seem, just like this nightingale, the bird that sings out in the dark. I'm JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and I am so happy to have you with me today as we explore a fundamental element of health, and that's the element of water. There's much talk today about blue health, the health of our waters, but so many of us continue to view water as just another commodity to be bought and sold, rather than an integral part of life, our life, and the life of the planet. So I was delighted to discover a new book called Ebb and Flow by Dr. Eske Britton. It's a hugely important book for our time. Well, that's my opinion anyway. Dr. Britton has a close relationship with water herself. She's a lifelong surfer. In fact, she's a pioneer of women's big wave surfing in Ireland. She's also a coach and a marine social scientist with a PhD in environment and society. Her book is both charming and fascinating, and it's also informative. I was delighted to be able to discuss it with her recently. Here's how the conversation went. Eske, your book is so beautifully written. It's poetic. I love it. There's so much of you in there. So there's that authenticity. You're so much in tune with water and our natural world. And you've even done the illustrations in the book, which are gorgeous. I love them. And I also loved the line in the press release that came from the publishers, and that is that Indigenous science has always known that water is spirit, the source of all life. The story of our human life begins in water, and renewing our sacred relationship to water is essential if we're to heal the waters of the world and heal ourselves too. Now, that is, you know, absolutely something that I hold dear, I believe in. So let's start off by just saying, first of all, how did this relationship with water develop with you?
Yes, good place to start. And yeah, how I came to write a book all about our relationship with water is very much, as you said, shaped and formed by my own experience with it from since before I can remember. And of course, the story of our human life begins in water. And it feels for me as if I, you know, rode this wave out into life. And I've been riding waves ever since. So I was born into a surfing family here in the northwest of Ireland. Both my parents were surfers. And I, stood up on a surfboard from the age of four, and I'm still surfing now, and my dad still surfs. And so all of that was a huge influence in my life in terms of the choices that I've made, but also in developing this really intimate, close relationship and understanding of the ocean and its impact on me and our lives, and also how much joy I've taken from it too.
Yeah, it's so great that you were on a surfboard from the age of four. How wonderful was that? And you know, you've studied the oceans as well, and you are very, very much an eco-warrior in terms of our oceans, our seas. So from that start, that early start, you went on to really become more and more involved, can we say, in the politics of water, the politics of the oceans. And I know that's something that you talk about in one of the chapters in your book.
Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way. I mean, I would have said maybe before that no, not politics, but actually, yes, of course, if it means that politics is about getting involved with issues that we care about. And you know, all the billionaires and fossil fuel corporations are intensely engaged in politics and would love if the rest of us stayed on the sidelines. So it's great to see, you know, that these movements to speak up for what we care about, like the environment and water. And so increasingly I do see a lot of what I do is about how I might give voice to that experience I've had in the ocean and to the importance of water in our lives and the importance of stories, because the stories that we listen to or tell ourselves, or that, you know, the stories really shape a lot of who we are and our culture and our beliefs. So they're really important. And we need stories now to counter this real dominance of the story of separation from nature, that we're somehow separate from, which means it makes it easier then to extract or consume or take what we want from a living planet. And you see that again and again, especially with our relationship where water is concerned.
Yeah, we really do. And last week I talked about going sea foraging with my friend and sometime guest on this show, Karen Brines-McLean. And it's lovely that we can go sea foraging along the part of the coast that we live near without fear of contamination. But not everybody is so lucky.
No, and I mean, in my work, what I'm always looking at are those entanglements, if you will, or interconnections between our human lives and the rest of the living world, and just how messy and complex and tangled up that all is. Yeah. And actually, the story even of pollution is one that highlights that, the power of that interconnection and interdependence with all living things. You know, if you look at the water and the quality of the water and for example, the amount of microplastics in the ocean is a big topic. But then also we are bodies of water and we also have microplastics in our bloodstream. So you know, there's no getting away from that fact that the two are completely interlinked, the health of the planet and our human health.
Yeah, absolutely. We are mostly water after all. Yeah, I get that. Now, and just looking at the book, which I say is beautiful, I love it. And going through it, I thought we'd follow the flow of the book and just, mention each chapter, because each chapter is very different. But you also have exercises to help people reconnect with water. So you've got journaling exercises and sort of suggestions of things that people can do to reconnect. But let's just talk a little bit more about exploring our human connection with water. So you talk about embodying the connection with water. How do we do that? What are the things that you would suggest that we can do for that?
Yeah, it's interesting when we talk about this, maybe the question also is why water, which is what one of the questions I'm curious to explore. Like, what is it about water that as humans we seem innately drawn to? And of course, it's a real paradoxical place because it also holds, you know, it's a place of fear and risk and danger, which is also perhaps part of the draw. And we'll get to that, I know, as well.
Yeah.
But that sense of, yeah, why water? A big reason is that it's when we come into contact with it, it's such an embodied experience. It takes us, you know, without much effort at all, out of our heads and into our bodies because it's so multisensory. It helps us to feel. And I think that, you know, feeling is really that process of becoming whole. So I hear, you know, again and again in my work through my research and then with interviews I carried out for the book, the importance of that sense of connection people feel in the water, but connection to themselves and their own bodies in a way that they've maybe never felt before. And also connection like socially, that sort of openness and trust it creates that allows us then to connect more deeply with each other. And of course, then the connection with the water itself and all these I suppose all the more than human lives that also depend on it and that we come into encounter as well, because we're, I think, part of the embodied part that's amazing with water is that we are in a way, many ways, crossing over into this other world and it makes us feel different. And it's a world that as humans, it's maybe, you know, it's not somewhere that we can survive in for very long. And yet it changes us. And then we are changed afterwards when we leave the water too, which was really fascinating to explore in the book a bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really does change you. And I know for a fact that when I go for a swim in seawater, if I'm in a, you know, if I'm feeling a bit grumpy or a bit tired or a bit, it all literally dissolves, right? All of that literally dissolves if you give yourself to the water and that experience. You can't think of anything else. If you're just in it, it's this most gorgeous, beautiful meditation, I guess.
And that's exactly what happens. It able Water has this capacity to really hold us in a gentle way in the present moment without it requiring so much effort in our part if we just show up and allow ourselves to be. And it's because, again, especially in cold water, which is an advantage perhaps for us here in
in Northern Europe.
in the UK and Ireland. And
Absolutely. And of course, colder weather further north, a lot of people break through the ice in winter to go and have a dip. But I don't think we have to do that here, do we?
Excellent. But no, and to get the benefits, you actually don't even have to go that extreme. I mean, even if it getting fully immersed isn't your cup of tea. Well, there's benefits in a cup of tea. So.
Yes.
But there's also water. But yeah, simply even looking at it, being near it, listening to it. It all has this psychological and restorative effect on us for lots of different reasons, and many of them are I would also be evolutionary in our sort of very DNA and biology for the crucial role that water has played in our survival throughout our time as humans on the planet, but then also recognizing increasingly these healing powers that waters have, or I suppose we're kind of beginning to reconnect with that.
Yeah. And even, I mean, for a long time in meditation tapes, you heard maybe the sound of waves lapping against the shore, so relaxing, or the sound of a stream or a river just flowing. Very, very relaxing. Just the sound of it.
Yes, it's amazing. It's written, most of the kind of white noise sound played for like babies is the sound of water and the ocean and that kind of. It in a way perhaps mimics being sloshed around in amniotic fluid in the womb,
maybe.
And that the heartbeat, the pulse of waves, very similar. And it's a real antidote. The sound of water in general, the sound that water creates, is an antidote to a lot of the noises that are in our everyday, more modern lives, which are more shrill and staccato and kind of for. It takes constant energy for the body to sort of filter them out, the background, more industrial hum to our everyday lives, which is actually is taking a lot of energy, but also it's causing those kinds of sounds, trigger a stress response in the body. So we have this then kind of like mild dose chronic stress response that builds up simply from the sounds around us in our everyday lives. So again, just listening, spending a little time listening to water can be the antidote to that, quite simply.
Yeah, well, I find it so, if anybody hasn't explored that, I do suggest that you do explore it, because it will help you if you are stressed. And you also look at flow. Water flows. It's its natural state. It flows. Even in the sea, there's an ebb and flow. And you use that as a metaphor for life and for flow in life. When you talk about flow, being in the flow when things are going our way, when we're stress-free maybe. But there's no it's no coincidence that we use the word flow because we're so connected, or because of that connection to water.
It's such a powerful metaphor when we look to it, to water, what we could learn from for our lives. But I think it's more than metaphor as well, which I kind of ended up kind of deep diving into in the chapter on flow, was also looking at the relationship between, our bodies and water. If we are water bodies and we're not, impermeable, our skin is actually really permeable as well. And how we want to move, if we started to move more fluidly as if we were water, what would that be like? And of course, movement is crucial for our health and our bodies, and also gets all the water in the different systems in our bodies moving. So it's really important for our health. And then looking to nature, following that theme of flow, and those fluid flow lines, and you just see it everywhere. Those patterns that water makes are always circular, and these spirals, and then that's repeated again in nature and the movement of seabirds and seashells. And so I go into all that in the book, and it actually ended up becoming an embodied practice that was tapping into that metaphor of water as a state of flow, and how to enter a state of flow ourselves, which happens when we're really present in the moment. And fully engaged in what we're doing without any distraction, and also where there's perhaps an element, there's an edge to it, which water can often bring up too, because it can be a challenging environment. So yeah, the topic of flow and water fascinates me. There's a whole other book there too.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can see that, and ebb and flow as well. You talk about, how water can be transformative, and again reflecting that in our own lives.
Yeah, so the on the yeah, I thought it was interesting with the book. Ebb is as important as flow, I feel, but it's really undervalued in our current kind of society. If we think of ebb as, and I ask people that I interviewed for in the book, what does ebb and flow mean to them? But ebb is this state of maybe pause. It's the trough rather than the peak experience. So it's maybe also when we're in this sort of low ebb state, so where we're not feeling like we're charging or firing on all cylinders, or where we're having to be with really uncomfortable or challenging emotions or situations. But it's how do we show up and be with that rather than trying to quickly move beyond it or suppress it. And so the ebb state is really important. I thought when you look to nature and how water behaves, with the tidal movements, everything is cyclical. There is an ebb and flow to everything, to night and day, to the lunar cycle, seasons, the movement of the sea itself with tides. And I thought, what would it be like if we started to live our lives more like that and honor the ebb as much as the flow? So the ebb being that phase of rest, as well as having that phase of action. And that's where a lot of the restoration happens and the healing. So that chapter then really starts to look at that relationship with water in context of healing, especially in times of grief, loss, and trauma.
So important. And as you were speaking, I'm thinking of hibernating animals as well. They just go to sleep for the winter, and then they burst forth in the spring, full of beans, ready to, continue life cycle. But it's what we all have to embrace as well. So many of us these days live 100 miles an hour, never stopping, and never having that rest. We don't have to hibernate through the winter, but having that period of saying, okay, this is my downtime.
Yeah, and maybe we should go at least a lot slower in winter time
Yeah, maybe.
if we are daylight creatures primarily, and then moved even with the sun. How different that would be. Exactly. And this being that kind of being unafraid to shed our leaves, so to speak. So looking at maybe what do we need to let go,
Yeah.
and that it's not a negative. Things dying or decaying or experiencing loss, but it's how to be with all of that. And then also those ebb states, as you rightly say, then it becomes that support and container for those moments of flow and action. Yeah.
And more people are beginning to recognize that rest is an important aspect of good health. We don't want to be constantly pushing ourselves, always in fight or flight mode. Well, we'll have more from Dr. Eastkey Britton in a moment. But first, it's time for a short break to hear this from our station sponsors.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Good, and you're listening to Alchemy 101 here on UK Health Radio with me, JJ, the Practical Alchemist, and my guest, surfer and scientist, Dr. Eske Britton, author of a new book called Ebb and Flow, which dives deep, pun intended there, into our relationship with water. Also, you talk about the mythology of water. Can we really ever get to know water? You already said, you know, we're not aquatic creatures. We are land-based animals, but we are composed of mostly water. We can't live in water, though. So can we ever get to know water properly? And what is the hold that water has had over us over so many, well, millennia, I guess?
Yeah. And, you know, as a scientist, I just love that water still holds such mystery for us. In fact, even with the ocean itself, so most of the surface of the planet is covered in ocean, and yet we understand so little of it. And in terms of what we've mapped or explored compared to even outer space, which is kind of astonishing. How, despite the fact that we're mostly land creatures, we do have this tie to the ocean, to water. I love that Rachel Carson, and you know, a writer, biologist, who wrote the very famous book Silent Spring in the 1960s, also wrote a lot about the ocean, some beautiful books on our relationship with the ocean. But she would say how we are all tied to our origins in the ancient sea. So from that evolutionary perspective, that we still carry that, you know, those sort of aquatic evolutionary markers in our blood, our cells and our DNA that connect us to water. And then when we go back to water or even splash our faces with water, some of those connections are triggered effortlessly. Like the mammalian dive response is one I find incredible. So we share this with all mammals, especially aquatic mammals, whales and dolphins and seals. And it's most alive in us in the first 6 months as babies, so that we, you know to hold our breath when we come into contact with water, that that's just innate there instinctively. But the mammalian dive response also prepares us for immersion in water, which is incredible. And so it reactivates instinctively again when we come into contact with it. So there's a whole series of physiological changes that happen in the body that prepare us for that, including the slowing of the heart rate, which again has huge health benefits if we're looking at things like ocean or water therapy. I'm probably going way off on a tangent there at mystery.
No, don't.
Mystery. Water is essential and all around us, and we've depended on it for millennia. And yet I find it incredible researching the book that we still can't really definitively say where water has come from in the universe. How did all the water end up on this planet? We are such a watery planet. And then all through human time, water has held such potency in our mythology. And in our stories, and also, you know, these and place connections. There's nearly always water when it comes to the sacred or trying to describe that the otherworldly or accessing it is nearly always through water. And all those crucial transition moments in the human life cycle involve water when we come into the world. And even still, how springs and wells hold this power that people go to and seek out for healing
very much
world
so.
Over. And it's very, very much so the case here in Ireland, of course, as well.
Yeah, very much the case here in the UK. I have lived near places where there have been, I suppose you would call them sacred wells, and people would take water from those expecting, if not to have a miracle happen, you know, expecting the water to help them heal in some way. It really is incredibly important for a lot of people, that kind of idea. And of course, in churches, you use holy water as part of ritual. So it's just been with us in some way for so, so long. And yet, do we even really think about it?
That's I know.
That's a fascinating thing, isn't it? It's just there. But of course, in your book, you then go on to kind of, in a very lovely, gentle way, remind us that water isn't just a commodity. It's far more than that. It really is life itself, as I said earlier when I was introducing our conversation. And it's difficult to for some people to get that notion out of their heads, because, you know, some people pay for their water. They pay for the water that comes into their house through their taps. We have hydroelectric power here in Scotland particularly, and in other places in the world. So we do tend to see it very much as something for us to harness and use. And you talk about that in one of the chapters in your book.
I do. And it's a theme, I think, throughout, even as a, you know, as a Blue Health researcher. So Blue Health is that kind of emerging body of science and practice looking at the healing power of water, blue spaces. But even that, there's a tendency to frame that as in still what can water do for us, rather than seeing us as interconnected and interdependent with water, that we actually are water. We are nature. And that story of, I suppose, commodifying nature is, again, a really dominant one that allows us to extract and pollute and take, rather than looking at the symbiosis, which is so important with, especially with water, because it holds all of who we are. And that's evident again. And it's a carrier of all our memory of all past lives, but also all pollutants that have ever been made. And that it's still so precious. We think of it as, especially this part of the world, at least, that it's readily available. And we live in a society where we just turn on the tap and there is water. And yet it is so precious, because the water that we have here on the planet right now is all the water there's ever going to be. And although it does renew itself and we have the water cycle, it even, you know, writing the book too, is looking at the complexities of that and how little of that water is available to us to drink and depend on, and how we're actually losing it and why I think maybe with the climate crisis narrative, not having water and the ocean in particular front and center is perhaps a big mistake, because it is really about the story of how water is changing from one state to another very rapidly.
And one way of connecting to it is and you talk people through it, or not talk because it's written in the book, but you know what I mean. You go through it with your readers. Do you know where your water comes from? Do you know what, where's it come from? Sit by your nearest body of water. Where's that water come from? What's it doing? What's your connection with it? It's a really great place to start, but I bet you very few people reading your book will have even thought to do that.
Yeah, I didn't either when I first sat down to write the book, and that question, it seems so simple, and I was really struck by, actually, I'm not entirely sure where the water I drink comes from, which is kind of mad when you think about how much we depend on it. And then even where's your nearest water body and getting to know it. And it could, even thinking about it, we might think about it has to be a wild river or lake or ocean, but it might be your nearest water body might be a canal. It could be a pond. It could, there's all these other forms it takes. And I recently had a lovely conversation and talk with one of the water walkers, who I also write about in the book, the water protectors in Canada, and she was saying how when it rains, which is obviously rains a lot here, but that's medicine falling from the sky. And so now I normally always have a laugh whenever it starts to rain, pour rain. And I had to give this talk the other day outdoors and give a reading about the sea, by the sea, and it was raining. So it actually turned out to be very fitting. And I thought, well, here's, we're receiving the medicine from the sky.
I love that. I'm going to start using that whenever it rains. I'm on the east coast of Scotland, though, so we don't have quite as much rain as you do in Ireland or on the west coast.
We get it all first.
Yeah, you get it exactly.
From the Atlantic seaboard. Absolutely. And again, the quality of the rain it's an interesting one too. I'm able to turn my face up and feel the raindrops on my face, but again, the knowing where does that rain come from, and it's also carrying everything that we're putting out there into the world as well. And so there's it's just a world of connection.
It is. And it's important to think of, I think it's important to think of water as this source of information. It carries all the information of everything that's going on in the world. And how we connect with that water carries an energy, it carries information around the world, I guess, because everything is interconnected. And then pollution, of course, we've touched on it a little bit. But I'm guessing that if we made more of a connection between ourselves and water, understood our existing connection between ourselves and water, we wouldn't be so cavalier when it comes to polluting our waters.
That is the hope. That it motivate us to want to care for what helps us thrive so much. And of course, as we're realizing all these amazing, you know, health and well-being benefits from things like sea swimming, wild swimming, blue health, ocean therapy, those very water bodies that we're dependent on for those experiences are being rapidly degraded. And they're also, you know, they're the most biodiverse, the most species rich, and they're also the most vulnerable and fragile. But I feel like the book is a story also of the power, water's power to renew, and those powers of renewal and tapping into them. What would that look like? But in order to do that, it requires this relationship of reciprocity, which is something that is central in Indigenous teachings and what I've learned from writers and thinkers and leaders in this area, like Robin Wall Kimmerer and her book, wonderful, beautiful book, Braiding Sweetgrass. So she would talk a lot about how we create this culture of reciprocity when we think about, you know, nature restoration. And it's great that that's becoming, you know, even on finally on the political agenda.
Yeah. Back to politics again. Yeah.
But that without also restoring our connection with nature, we will fall short, you know. So I think that's really important, is to bring back that kind of intimacy and closeness again with the rest of the living world is essential for its restoration, but also our own. And we have so much to benefit from that.
I totally agree with you, obviously. but just talking about the power and the power of water and talking about pollution. Now, you give an example of salmon and how incredibly sensitive salmon are to the waters that they live in and spawn in. And, you know, I think maybe in Ireland as well as here in the UK, we've seen, or we did see, salmon populations declining quite markedly over time. It's only now that we're beginning to see, you know, them coming back because they are so sensitive to pollution. And I love the description that you gave of how salmon use the power of water to leap. There's a very famous salmon leap in Pitlochry in the Highlands here in Scotland. And it's fantastic watching them leap up there. I've always wondered how they do it. You describe how they do it. Tell us.
Oh, there's so much to learn from other species, but I have a close affinity with salmon, which I also maybe mentioned in the book about my name, Iski, coming from the word fish, but also named after this surf break where a very famous salmon river flows into the Atlantic Ocean. And then one of our strongest mythologies in Ireland is the salmon of knowledge.
Yeah.
And again, now looking to those mythologies, it's actually a story of this ecological interdependence, which a lot of myths and legends actually are telling us about that connection and the importance of it. So, for example, with this salmon of knowledge, there is this sacred well or pool of water surrounded by hazel trees that have this magical power, 9 hazel trees. And when the hazels fall into the water, the salmon feed on the hazels and then receive the wisdom of the universe. And then they swim out into the world. And and so, and they're the carriers of that knowledge, which, of course, now from an ecological perspective, when we look at that mythology, we're now just beginning to realize how important having healthy, intact forests and rainforests along our coasts are for having healthy ecosystems and ocean ecosystems. And also the role salmon play in that sort of cycle of returning to the rivers and bringing a little of the ocean back into those forests and so on. And probably, yeah, really maybe read the book for that part. But I find it mind-blowing that there's this, you know, today's science is now actually validating a really what is already the lesson that is already held there in that ancient mythology. But to go back to what we can also learn from salmon today is just how incredibly adapted they are to water. Like they're completely shaped and formed by water. And so with the shape of a salmon, they've evolved in such a way that allows them to be able to leap up these waterfalls and use as water falls, it falls in this obviously circular spiral pattern and creates these vortexes. And so the salmon actually use those, that energy of the water to leap upwards in these vortexes because the way water spirals around their bodies, which is incredible. And again, yes. Just the how intricately all of these things are connected, because it depends too on the temperature of the water on our rivers. And of course, the colder the water is, the more dense it is. And so the easier it is for the salmon to be able to make that leap.
It's absolutely brilliant. I love hearing all about all of that kind of thing. And if you've ever watched a salmon leap, you'll see that it does kind of with its body, it does kind of do some kind of corkscrew kind of effect, as if it is going through a vortex. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, where we've been lucky enough to spot salmon, which is these days pretty rare.
Yes.
doing their return migration. But yes, yeah.
Yes, I have fond memories of watching salmon leaping here in Scotland. There really is something almost magical about that species of fish, and I can see how it's become part of Irish myth and legend. Right now, though, it's time for us to leap into more messages from our station sponsors. We'll be back right after this.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And you're listening to Alchemy 101 on UK Health Radio, the world's number one talk health radio, with me, JJ, the practical alchemist, and my guest, Dr. Iski Britton, the author of a wonderful new book called Ebb and Flow. Another area that the book touches on is blue health and the efforts being made to clean up our waterways and oceans. Dr. Britton mentions some of the organisations working towards cleaner water worldwide, and I was curious to explore what we can do individually. What is it that we can do to help restore our waters? Now, again, you know, I know that on the coast by me, we have very clean water, luckily. That's partly down to the fact that we have a lot of quite ecologically sound farming on the water's edge. So we don't have too much runoff. Also, although there is some a lot of plastic pollution a bit further around from where I live on the Firth of Forth, the Forth Estuary, it doesn't quite get round the corner to us. So we're very lucky. We've got this very clean environment. And I know that a lot of people even still go out onto the beaches and they collect rubbish. Whenever I go swimming, we're collecting things off the beach and just putting them in the bins. we can just start there, can't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful way to start. It, you know, because it's bringing people together and creating an awareness of things we use in our everyday lives and discovering them in a place maybe that they shouldn't be. Mm. But thinking about how did it end up there and what is the way we could even prevent it ever ending up in the ocean in the first place.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful way. We've carried out studies in my work and in Blue Health too, looking at how even those activities are also enhancing. The very act of doing that is an act of reciprocity. So it enhances our social well-being. It's a great way to kind of come together in groups. You might, you know, you could be a group of strangers, but because you're doing the shared activity on the beach, on the coast, it of course has this feel good factor. There's that, even the, you know, the act of taking part in it has the benefit for us. And yeah, I mean, the scale of the problems may seem so overwhelming, which can make it even, you know, can kind of numb us into inaction, which is the worst possible thing.
Yeah.
For me, I think the starting place is always, again, when I talk about reciprocity and connection and that intimacy with place. So it begins with wherever you are. You maybe, you know, read about the scale of the problems on a global level, global scale. But with water, it's all the same. It's all connected. The drop of water that's, you know, dripping out of your tap is going to be the water that's also in the global oceans.
Yeah.
So that for me offers a brilliant opportunity to start wherever we are, however great or small, with that question of, well, where is your water and how is it doing? And then from there, it's really about building up that kind of ocean literacy, that water literacy in our society again, which is simply about understanding how and why we're inextricably linked, the health of the ocean and our health. How much we depend on it and vice versa. But to be ocean literate also is about to become more fluent in the language of the ocean, the language of water. And by that, I mean, it's about listening to water again. What can we learn from it, being by it, spending time just sitting with it? So it's almost all these things we would do in any relationship of getting to know someone that we've just met, perhaps. But applying that to water in our lives is a wonderful way to start to restore that connection. And then, yeah, acting, I think, mindfully is really important. I loved in Christiana Figueres' book, The Future We Choose. So she was instrumental in getting the climate agreement at COP in Paris in 2015. But I find it interesting that they argued for greater mindfulness in our approach to how we live. So learning to create a gap between ourselves, the world, and our reactions. So we're often, the way our societies and cultures are designed, increasingly we end up in this reactive mode where we're just, you know, reacting to triggers and things that happen or get thrown our way. And we don't have a moment to breathe or to pause or to even take a one moment meditation, as it were. But how important that is then, because it allows us to actually make those connections between our thoughts and our actions and the wider world, which is also a really important part of the solution. So yeah, there's all those kinds of things. And then the more, I suppose, hands-on ways of getting involved in cleanups and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we can't get overwhelmed by seeing plastic islands in the middle of the ocean. You see lots of pictures of those on social media, and we might go, oh, you know, that's terrible, and then feel completely disempowered, because what can you do about that? So it is about starting small, just looking at your own backyard.
Where you are. Yeah, I think so. And I came across a fascinating project I read about in the book, the River Listening Project, headed by Leah Barclay. Started in Australia, but there is a wonderful example again. So she actually uses a hydrophone to record the song of the rivers, as it were. And rivers that are most biodiverse and alive and free flowing and wild have this wonderful cacophony, or symphony, I should say, of sounds of how the water moves, but everything that's living in the water that we can't hear beneath the surface. And I've never really thought about that when it comes to rivers before. And then she also records the sounds in rivers that have been dammed and polluted, and they're just silent. And so it's really striking. But she then also records rivers where there's been great kind of collective community initiatives to clean up the water and to care for the river again. And you can hear the sounds coming back. And perhaps it's a new song that the river makes. It will never be like the one before. But isn't that a wonderful example of, again, that power of renewal through connection, through restoring these connections?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. It's the most relaxing thing. I'm not a fisherman, woman, person. I have, though, accompanied people up in the Highlands when they've been salmon fishing or fly fishing. And actually, the best thing is just sitting there and listening to the river, just listening to the water and maybe seeing a fish jump to catch a fly, and hearing that sort of plop as it gets back into the water. And then maybe seeing a kingfisher or seeing some of the other birds around, maybe a dipper, or, you know, and hearing them as well. It is as relaxing as something that I do most days here, nearly every day, and that's just listen to the waves on the sea. Every time I go to swim, which is virtually every day here, I'm going to go for a swim in a short while after this.
Mm.
Every day when I go for a swim, I listen to the waves. And no matter what the weather is like, it's almost like it takes me to another place of just sheer relaxation. And I'm minded of, you know, times when I've been on a Greek island, say, or somewhere very warm and exotic, and you're just lying there on the beach listening to the waves. And it reminds me that I don't have to be on a Greek island. I don't have to be anywhere. I can just be here in the UK and get the same effect. And isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And even more so how it's wonderful that we have this on our doorstep. I live here in Donegal on a beach called Rosnaula, and just literally the sea is across the road from where I live.
Mm.
But also how, because we are bodies of water, we can access these experiences wherever we are. And people often, it's one of the most common questions I get asked, sort of, how do I connect with water, with ocean, if I live inland, if I live in a city, I talk about that in the book and different ways to do that. But even one really simple one, yet powerful, is taking that breath in, as I call it, the ocean breath, and making that connection with, you know, every second breath we take actually comes from the ocean. So phytoplankton, those tiny microscopic plants in the ocean, actually produce about 60% of the oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah,
it is remarkable to think that the ocean is breathing for us. And so it's a wonderful way then just to take that mindful few breaths. And even if it's just a couple of breaths in our day, as a way to honor our ebb and connect with the ocean wherever we are.
Oh, that's such a wonderful thought, and a wonderful thought, unfortunately, to end on, because I could talk to you all day about this. I'm so delighted that you could join me today. Yeah, and who really would think that when you're breathing in the ocean, that's a fabulous fact to store away and just be mindful of as we go through our daily lives, wherever we are. Oh, Iski, thank you so much for coming onto the show and talking to me about this. Best of luck with your book, which is out now. And I hope that people will go and buy it. It really is the most delightful, lovely book, but also really important, and a really important book for our times, I believe. So thank you so much for writing it too.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Lovely to talk about it with you, JJ.
You're welcome. And yes, I really do recommend that everyone should get a copy of this very important book and soak up the wisdom in it. It's called Ebb and Flow, and it's beautifully illustrated with line drawings by Iski, Dr. Britton herself. They make it quite special. The book also has exercises to help us connect with water. Healthy water is essential for our health, so let's reconnect for everyone's sake. And that really is it for today. Remember, you can listen to all of our shows on all the main podcast platforms these days. And if you appreciate our shows or if they've helped you, do help us spread the word by liking them and sharing them. You never know, it might just be what someone you know needs to hear. Also, check out the show I co-host with psychiatrist and coach Dr. Mark Goulston here on UK Health Radio. It's called Hurt Less, Live More, and it's the place for raw, open, uplifting and hopefully enlightening conversations with fantastic guests. For even more health information, there's our sister publication, Health Triangle magazine. That's a monthly magazine that's full of great features complementing our radio shows. And you can subscribe online at ukhealthradio.com. And meanwhile, I hope you'll join me again here next time. And until then, it's goodbye from me and that nightingale.